This is an interview with Betty Roberts in her home in Southeast Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society's Clark Hansen. The date is September 19th, 1908. And I was just about to ask you whether there were any judges on the court who were particularly effective in influencing other judges. And we've talked a little bit about Hans Lindy and Doc Campbell in that regard.
Right. I think on every court there are those judges who prefer just to work alone, to write their opinions, to put them in, to conference, let conference discuss them, and sort of the Doc Campbell approach, and not worry about preparing other judges for it, not trying to get other judges to agree beforehand or that sort of thing. But on the other hand, there are the judges like Hans Lindy, who's probably the outstanding example on our court, who want to be involved in many of the opinion, want to be involved in the decision making at the opinion writing stage.
Mm-hmm.
And even if an opinion is assigned to another judge, he very frequently will send a memo about kind of his analysis, of not a complete analysis, but some issue that he thinks is important or that needs to be addressed, or some a method by which the case could be resolved, and so on. And of course, Hans is a former law professor, now that he's retired, a law professor again, as a teacher, and a very bright, sharp, legal, analytical mind, this was just Hans that he couldn't help himself from doing that. You know, this was his method of operation. Others on the court, and particularly after an opinion was written, then he would want to go and talk to some of the judges and say, well, you know, I like this or whatever, but we really need to do this and add some language or talk about this. Other judges, like Bud Lent, for example, were really admired for detail work, mm-hmm. For being very careful the facts and the analysis and not missing any points. And sometimes coming up with some very innovative ways of resolving issues. We look to Bud very frequently, and for all of the judges, none of us have any hesitation about going to another judge and talking about an area of the law that we felt that they might have more expertise in than the person the opinion was assigned to write. And we never had any hesitation about going and talking to a judge about a judge's opinion, even before we'd go in conference. I didn't. If I was concerned about something, I would, in fact, it was almost a courtesy to go and say, I'm not sure I'm going to support you in this opinion when we get into conference because, and I'll hear your argument there, or you can tell me now, or whatever. Everybody kind of played a different role on the court, and that's the purpose of a collegiate court. The purpose is to have some different backgrounds, different expertise, different viewpoints, different past experiences, and they all come together to make a better court. I think if you had all trial judges on an appellate court, it wouldn't function well. You need some scholars, you need professors, you need people who've worked in different areas of the law, and they bring that expertise and their own personalities and the way they work to the bench.
What advantages does the Chief Justice have in being able to accomplish these ends?
Well, the Chief Justice, of course, is able to assign all of the cases out to the judges, and the chief has to, in doing that, analyze what the workload of that judge already is. Generally, everybody hated tax cases. I didn't very much, but But it was always, you know, rotate tax cases because nobody wanted to get them. And so you always hoped that when it came up your turn, that it wasn't one that in which they brought in a whole room full of exhibits of some sort that you had to go through. And so no judge became an expert in, or no judge was assigned all one kind of cases, criminal law or workers' comp or family law or whatever, so that no judge was known to lawyers in the state as being the expert on this on the Supreme Court. Every judge wrote on every kind of case imaginable. And the Chief Justice controlled that, because after argument, the Chief Justice would then assign the cases that we had heard for that month. And usually the day after our third day of argument, we'd have the sheet that would be distributed showing who got what cases. And so we all had a mix that we were working on all the time.
Were there, we've talked a little bit about streamlining of the courts already, but were there any techniques or procedures that you were involved in that helped streamline the courts?
Well, I worked on a revision of the rules, Supreme Court rules that govern how briefs are filed and how motions are filed, time frames for that, what the it's a set of rules for lawyers to follow so that they know what their time schedule is, how they do their briefs, how long the briefs can be. And it's the lawyer relationship with the court. If there is ever any reason to not comply with those rules, then they have to get special permission not to comply. They need a longer period of time if they want a brief longer, and so on. We did some streamlining of those rules while I was there, and I chaired a committee that did that. But other than that sort of thing, really the streamlining is just kind of by mutual agreement. If we decide, for example, that we want to have argument on a different day, while I was there, most of the time it was on Wednesday. We'd changed it once, I think, from Tuesday to Wednesday. I understand it's changed now to another day in the week. So different people come on and say, I think our work schedule would go better if we have our conference day on a different day of the week, and in order that we can work more efficiently other parts of the week, or that we schedule our arguments for different days or whatever. Those are kind of joint and mutual decision-making. But otherwise, the Chief Justice is the one who really may propose streamlining, certainly in terms of trial court and the other courts of the state. But the Chief Justice would never do that alone. The Chief Justice would not impose any kind of thing. He would simply have a committee. He's got an executive committee that works with him that's made up of a number of judges throughout the state.
Are they all judges on the committee?
Yeah, and even I'm on the committee now as a senior judge, because senior judges get one representative on the executive committee, but trial judges and from the Court of Appeals and the Chief Justice, and they take up and talk about things like this. People have proposals and ideas for making the court more efficient, and so consider them and make changes. And the Chief Justice is sort of just the leader in that, and chairs this executive committee.
I thought I might ask you a few questions just about the court in general and about the legal profession. In general, could you describe what your view of the role of the court is in broad general terms?
Well, I don't know. The role of the court is to resolve legal disputes of any court. Are you talking about the role of the Supreme Court? The role of the Supreme Court is to be the last decision maker, unless it is a federal constitutional question, which can then be appealed from the state Supreme Court to the United States Supreme Court. It does not have to go through the appellate level of the federal system.
Oh, really?
No.
You go straight from the state Supreme Court to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, to the United States Supreme Court.
And then who decides?
If a constitutional question, Who decides?
Then the U.S. Supreme Court would decide whether they want to take up that case or leave it with the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, and who decides where it's going? One of the litigants, whoever lost.
I see.
In our court, would then say, well, I'm going to take this federal constitutional question all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they file it up there. Mm-hmm. And then they go and argue, they file their briefs and they argue, and that court will either deny review, and if that's the case, then the state Supreme Court decision stands. If they accept review, then they hear arguments and they write an opinion on it.
All right.
And whatever that opinion is, it controls. Mm-hmm. So but it's not unusual that the U.S. Supreme Court may remand a case for further reason back to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to do something with it again. I mean, you know, it depends on what the issue is and how they decide it. But the role of the Supreme Court is really to be the policymaker, to be the final, to have the final word. On all state issues, so it's a very important role.
Should lower court judges be legal innovators, or should they leave that to the legislature and the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, I frankly kind of like to see trial judges be, quote, legal innovators, whatever that term may mean. But for example, right now in criminal law, you know, we all feel so frustrated about the fact that it seems as though that our prison system is not certainly rehabilitating people, it's not working. We have more and more young people, juveniles, as early as 8, 10, 11 years old, getting into the system and what to do with them. And I like to see trial judges come up with some innovative ways of dealing with these people to try to not just say, okay, you get a month in jail, kid, or out at the juvenile home, and you know very well that kid's going to come out no better than he was when he went in.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things have you seen?
Well, one that really created a flap here in Oregon was when Judge Dorothy Baker requested that a man who had been convicted of child molesting put on outside his apartment doorway that a child molester lives here or something like that, you know, in order, sort of a warning to other people that who I am, and I've been, but it was an alternative to going to prison if, you know, he put this thing there. And ACLU got into this and said it was an invasion of his right of privacy, you know, and that you're stigmatizing this guy, and, you know, and I don't know what happened to the case, you know, I don't know, you know, and so people line up on both sides. Well, why not let all of us know? You know, we want to protect our kids. What right does this guy have to privacy when he's invading the privacy of my child?
The alternative being prison,
right,
which is a much greater right of invasion of privacy.
Right. And, you know, and then what gets into cruel and unusual punishment under the federal constitution and that sort of thing, you know, so it always raises a flap, you know, but that's okay. Judges ought to be, they ought to say, I think we need to do something. Now, it means that when they are innovative, probably those cases are going to get appealed.
Right.
But it may, but that may be okay, because then some good ideas come out, and courts say, yes, you can do this, or no, you can't do this, and for what good reasons, if there are good reasons. And so, trial judges cannot be innovators in that they can decide what laws they want to enforce and not enforce, or amend laws to meet the facts of a case or something of that sort. No, they should not be legislators. They should be judges. But there's certainly some leeway in innovation. Another very good example of innovation is right here in our court in Multnomah County, in which Judge Harl Haas worked on setting up, and for a long time he was the only judge who would work these cases, was the drug diversion treatment programs. He has now convinced two or three other judges to join him and give him some relief in doing this. It requires some supervision. It requires that the defendant come back in to the court, and the reports be made to the court on how this person's doing these diversion treatments programs. But they're having some success. If these people succeed in those programs, then they don't have to go to jail. If they don't succeed, then they do. And so that's a real heavy hammer hanging over those people's head, and it gives them some incentive and motivation that maybe they can't stir up on their own. Those kinds of things are great, you know, and I think that more trial judges ought to try some of them.
Are there factions on the or blocks on the Supreme Court?
Well, yeah, not factions, because we don't, you know, factions to me sort of mean arguing, or not liking each other, or not working with each other. But there are blocks. I know that when I was on the court, that Hans Lindy and Bud Lent and Roberts were considered to be kind of the liberal wing of the court, and then Ed Peterson and Doc Campbell, and after Bob Jones got there, sort of the conservative, particularly in criminal cases, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, and then Wally Carson was more conservative. He would more often vote with those than with us, but he was more the swing vote,
mm-hmm.
It didn't happen often, sometimes on free speech cases, sometimes on some search and seizure cases, those sorts of things, when we would see some distinct difference. But generally, unlike the U.S. Supreme Court, where there does tend to be a much more obvious block. And I think because of presidential appointments, in terms of trying to keep that court in balance, or appointing people that have the philosophy of the president and how long they stay on, and then who comes along and gets appointed later when there's a different president. You don't see that as much on state court, certainly not on our court, but every once in a while it would occur.
Do you ever see people's personal philosophies change once they're on the court?
Not really change. I think sometimes that once on the court, for example, Bud Lent was in the legislature, I was in the legislature, Wally Carson was in the legislature. In fact, we all served there together at one time. Bob Jones had served briefly back in the early 60s in the legislature. And so we all kind of knew how each other would vote on those kinds of issues, because you voted every day, you know, here or there. And I don't think really any of our philosophies changed. I think what happened was that we sort of mellowed out. There was no partisanship on the court. We didn't elect our Chief Justice because he was a Democrat or Republican. And so there was no organization of who gets a chairmanship because of what party you belong to, or who gets what cases because of what party you belong to. But I know that there were a few instances in which I did not agree with Bud Lent on some cases, and would then vote with a majority. And sometimes Bud and Hans would be the dissenters, and I would not join them. And the same thing would be true with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you look at these things differently than you do when you're in a partisan legislative body.
What communication advice or supervision does the Supreme Court give, and the justices on the Supreme Court give to the lower court judges outside their written opinions?
Well, not any, as far as any particular case is concerned, but at judicial conference, I mean, no judge will call up, to my knowledge, no judge will call up a trial judge and say, hey, this is why we decided this case. I mean, the opinion is the opinion of the full court, and it has to speak for itself.
Mm-hmm.
It would be very inappropriate if a judge had communication with a trial judge other than through the opinion, because it would be only that judge's opinion and not the full court's opinion. But in judicial conference, which we have every spring, there is regular, I mean, all the judges are there, trial court judges, appellate judges, they have an opportunity to kind of talk about things, and frequently opinions are referred to, and trial judges will express some thoughts about it, how difficult it is, or, you know, or why did the court decide this, and, you know, or the trial judges hate to be reversed. And, you know, so sometimes it's a joking situation in which, you know, they'll say the Supreme Court didn't know what it was doing, you know, when it reversed me. Or the Court of Appeals, more likely, because they have more cases. But really, there is no communication in terms of the cases, to my knowledge, between any of the trial court judges and the appellate judges, except by opinion writing.
Sort of conversely, what are the purposes of dissent in the lower courts?
Wait a minute. In a lower court, there is no dissent. You mean in the trial court? Trial judge, one judge. He decides.
But then
the jury decides.
But then on the Court of Appeals, then there is the prevailing opinion and dissent.
Oh, yeah. Now, I think we've talked about this because I talked about how much fun it was to write dissents. And then you just wait to see if the Supreme Court will pick up on your points in the dissent, or if they'll reverse the majority on the Court of Appeals. And it's always a thrill if they do.
And then what about on the Supreme Court, the role of dissent on the Supreme Court? Does it have any purpose? Since that's where it's, the case
well,
is ending.
Particularly if it's going to go on up to the U.S. Supreme Court, a dissent is very important. And it's sending a message kind of thing. If it's a case that is going to be terminated at the Supreme Court, and it depends upon whether it's a 4-3 dissent, 5-2, or only one person dissenting, the dissenting opinions can sometimes explain to lawyers why the majority is the majority and why there is a dissent for future cases. So that when the personnel of the court changes, or if the circumstances of another case might be different, you know, they might get a different outcome.
You've talked about the collegiality of the court, and I was wondering, in terms of the court reaching an agreement, does the opinion writer have an extra responsibility in achieving agreement or brokerage?
Well, when you go into conference, the opinion writer speaks first and explains the opinion. Usually it's brief, because most everything's in the opinion, but if you want to talk about why this case, why some case you've used in the opinion is important, or how you reached this reasoning process in the opinion, then the writer has the first shot to try to convince. Then the Chief Justice may speak first on that opinion. And if there's a dissent may speak to that. Then the Chief Justice speaks first, and it goes around the table in order of seniority. And so the writer does have an opportunity to put forth. The writer does have an opportunity to put forth his or her opinions initially, and to try to influence the court.
Have the demands on the court changed since you were appointed?
Well, I only served 4 years on the court, and the court can, by reason of it having discretionary jurisdiction, determine its workload, but and I don't know whether they have been taking more cases. I know that more cases are going through the Court of Appeals, and it's taking a longer time for those cases to be decided in the Court of Appeals. This has to have had some effect on the Supreme Court in terms of numbers of petitions that are filed. And petitions take an awful long time. So I would assume that, yes, the Supreme Court has, since I was there, last there in 86, that probably the workload has increased.
What do you see as the chief problem facing the court today?
I think the chief problem always facing an appellate court is the quality of judges. I think we've got some good judges on the court now. Are not many there that I served with now. Wally Carson is there. We have another woman on the Supreme Court now, Susan Graber. She's the second woman to serve there and is the only woman serving. And I assume that everyone there is well qualified. I know many of them personally, and so I think that it's probably a good court and working hard. But it's usually up to the governor to appoint in between elections. And I would like to see more women on the court. I would love to see the day when there's a majority of women, when there's four women and three men, for example, or at least three women on that court, and at least four or five on the Court of Appeals. And I had hoped that the current governor, Barbara Roberts, would have appointed more women to both of those courts. She has made many, many appointments, women appointments at the trial level, and hopefully those women will work up and either run or some future governor will appoint them. From my standpoint, I think that it's important to have minority representation on the court, which we have none. Have no minority on either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court in this state, and to have more women. It's important because it's not only that these people from different backgrounds and from different experiences, what they bring to the court, but it's the appearance of fairness to the litigants who may be women or minorities. And a court very frequently functions, I mean, its authority very frequently turns on whether, how the citizens view that court. If they think that it is truly impartial and is truly fair, it's going to have a great deal more respect than if it's made up of all of one class of people, all white males, for example. So my concern is that we do not have enough diversity on either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, and ultimately that will happen, but how long from now will happen? It should not take so long for it to happen.
Mm-hmm. What relationship do you see between punishment and reform?
Well, I'm not sure that punishment reforms anyone. I've never been an advocate of punishment. I'm opposed to capital punishment. There's no evidence that it has deterred anyone from committing a capital crime.
But what about other kinds of punishment, prison sentences, fines?
Recidivism is so high in terms of people who go to jail, get out, go again, get out, go again, get out, and go again. You know, that you can almost say that, what good is it to go there except to isolate them from society, to keep them from, from committing more crimes. Bob Jones has this kind of interesting story about how he looked at the prison system, and that was that, sure, we used to have and may still have a training program at state prison teaching inmates how to make furniture. His theory was that you send a robber in there and he learns how to make furniture, he comes out and you have a robber who knows how to make furniture. he goes back to robbing. And unless that talent can be applied once they're out and they can have a job and they can do what they're trained to do. Mm-hmm. And not everybody wants to build furniture. I mean, you know, so there has to be a whole variety of kinds of programs for people who are incarcerated. I think that probably that prison and punishment is appropriate in some very extreme cases. I think we have people in our society who, no matter what we do with them, are not able to live in a civilized society without harming someone. And how they come to be that way, you know, is something we need to find out from what happened to them when they were, what their genes are, what their environment was when they were very early on that caused this. But with that exception, you know, I have hope for everyone, and that is that we should develop programs. We need one-on-one community programs. We need stronger parents who can say no to kids and who can control kids. And we're in a situation right now in our society where it almost appears hopeless. I have faith that it will turn.